Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 74 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. If you've talked to medievalists before, you've been in on some of their inside jokes and just sitting next to them at the pub talking amongst themselves, you've probably heard the name Marjorie Kemp come up. And if you haven't actually learned anything about Marjorie Kemp, well, today is your lucky day because Marjorie Kemp is a character, a real person, but a real character from the Middle Ages who is really unforgettable. And I thought, we haven't talked about Marjorie before, so let's talk about Marjorie today. Marjorie Kemp was a woman who lived in Bishop's Lynn, which is now known as King's Lynn, which is on the eastern coast of England. And she was just kind of a middle-class woman going through her life before she became a holy woman. And we know what we know about Marjorie from her own book, which she just calls the Book of Marjorie Kemp, which is thought to be the first autobiography by a woman in the English language. So this is kind of a big deal, this book. She didn't actually write it herself because she wasn't literate. She dictated this to a scribe. Actually, it's kind of a comedy of errors how that went. We'll get to that in a second. But she dictated this book that explains her life, how she got to be sort of a holy person, and the revelations that she had. I came across the Book of Marjorie Kemp in my undergraduate classes, and I read it kind of at the same time as I read Julian of Norwich's book. And they're actually contemporaries, and they actually meet, which is kind of interesting. So let's talk about the Book of Marjorie Kemp. We're not going to dive into sort of an analysis. I'm just going to give you the rundown of her life because it's really super interesting and it gives us lots of details about what life was like in the late 14th century and early 15th century. So if you find it easier to position yourself in time with kings, it's the time of Henry IV and Henry V and the beginning of Henry VI's reign, but before things really kind of get amped up in the Wars of the Roses. So the preface to the Book of Marjorie Kemp is interesting in itself. It explains how the book came to be, which is a comedy of errors. So Marjorie, you'll notice she is kind of the queen of the humble brag. So it says in the preface that people were telling her for years she needed to write down the story of her life. For 20 years, she didn't do it until one day God told her, you need to tell everyone the story of your life. And so she got someone to write it down for her. It was a person who had come to England from Germany, and he wrote a lot of it, but not all of it. And then he wasn't able to continue. So Marjorie asked a priest to continue this book, writing this book for her. And the priest was like, oh, it's not even good English. It's not good German. I don't even know what it is. I can't possibly write this for you. And the priest has excuse after excuse for about 4 years. He's like, my eyesight's not good. I'm having trouble reading it, which they all think is kind of maybe devilish intervention. But eventually, Marjorie gives it to somebody else. He does a bad job of it as well. And the original priest is like, okay, fine, I'll do it. And miraculously, he can read it a lot better than he did before. So he writes this down. It's said to have been written, at least in the book itself, in 1436. So that kind of gives you a date to work with. So let's get to the story. Marjorie starts by saying that when she was 20 years old, she married a man from Bishop's Lynn named John. And he was a burgess. So they got married and she very quickly got pregnant, which again, you'll not be too surprised about as we go on. And she had a very difficult pregnancy, according to her. She had a difficult birth and afterwards things went really badly as well. The book says that she went out of her mind, and that's a quote, she went out of her mind for more than half a year, so probably around 8 months or more. She had what we would probably now call postpartum psychosis. So for Marjorie, this manifested as she saw devils around her. They were hurting her. They were physically hurting her. And they were asking her to renounce Jesus, which she did. She said horrible things to her husband, horrible things to her family and friends. She bit herself so badly that she scarred herself. She scratched herself with her nails. She was really she was a danger to herself. She was suicidal. She was in despair. And so she was actually bound, according to her book. She was bound and she was taken care of by keepers, as she says. One day, she says her keepers left her alone, and Jesus came to her. And he came dressed in purple silk, and he sat on the edge of her bed and said, "Why have you forsaken me when I've never forsaken you?" And then he disappears. And from that moment on, Marjorie has control of her senses once again. And the first thing she does is when her husband comes in, she asks for the keys to the buttery so she can have something to eat and drink like she did. And all of the friends and neighbors and family are like, "John, don't give her the keys." But he loves her, so he does. And everything is normal. She goes back to eating and drinking as normal. So from there, it talks about how she was rescued, her sanity was rescued by Jesus, but she's still not the most humble creature. And she's wearing fancy clothes all the time. She says it's because she was proud and covetous that she becomes one of the best brewers in Lynn. And things don't always go very well. So she becomes one of the best brewers in Lynn, and yet things go wrong. Time after time, something goes wrong with the yeast. So she finally gives that up. She figures this is probably a divine lesson as well. She apologizes to her husband for talking back to him all the time. And she decides she's going to switch gears and careers. So she switches to milling. She gets herself a mill and some horses, but that doesn't work out either. So she starts to, again, see this as a divine sign. She starts to do what she calls great bodily penance. She forsakes her pride and she starts to live a more heavenly life. But when she does this, and this is kind of why I love this book, when she becomes a more holy person, she does it to the irritation of just about everybody that she meets. So she says that when she first becomes a follower of Jesus in a really earnest way, she prays to him to give her uncontrollable weeping so that she can show her devotion to him. And she doesn't even care if it's going to bother people. She just wants to be overwhelmed by emotions when she thinks about Jesus and his life. And this is what happens. So Marjorie becomes saintly, but very, very annoying. So right after she's talking about, you know, things going wrong in her businesses, she says she was sleeping next to her husband one night and she hears this beautiful music and she knows it's heavenly music. And so it says after this, all she talks about is heaven all the time. So her friends and family start getting annoyed with her. They stop talking to her because every time she sees them, all she talks about is heaven. And there's a quote in here where what she says to people is, "It is full merry in heaven." So things are just wonderful there. People get really exasperated with her for all this. And they say to her, "Why are you talking about heaven? You haven't been there any more than we have." Which I think is like just a beautiful example of what it must have been like trying to have dinner with Marjorie. So they're like, "Yep, you don't even know what you're talking about. Why are you talking to us about heaven?" Not everybody is really receptive to her. And this is when she starts in her story to talk about her journey to becoming a chaste wife. So she's married to John, but she doesn't want to be fully a wife. She doesn't want to sleep with him anymore. At this point, she says she doesn't want to sleep with him. She would rather drink or eat the muck from the channel than actually sleep with him anymore. She says to John that they are displeasing God by enjoying sex so much. And they should probably stop. They should probably be chaste. And John says, "You know, that's a good idea, but we don't need to stop yet. We'll stop when God wants it." So Marjorie's trying to get him to stop sleeping with her for 3 or 4 years. In this time, she's going to church. She's going to church 2 or 3 times a day. Sometimes she's going in the middle of the night and she's praying all day. People are getting annoyed with her because when she's in church, she's noisy. She's crying all the time and lamenting. People are making fun of her for this. But this isn't enough for her. She gets herself a hair shirt. It's not quite a hair shirt per se, in that it seems to have just been a piece of material that she puts under her dress and she hides from her husband because she doesn't really want his disapproval either, I suppose. She says he never notices it, even though they sleep together every night. So I'm not sure if this is because she's still wearing it to bed at night or he's not noticing the kind of itchy rash she's getting from wearing this hair shirt all the time. when she is going to church two or three times a day, people are making fun of her, calling her a hypocrite, saying you could stop crying if you wanted to. She's thinking back to a mysterious sin that she had in her childhood, or at least before she was married, it seems. This is something that she's been worried about for a long time, but we never actually get to find out what this sin was, so you can imagine. But maybe it has something to do with the next bit, which is, so she's going to church all the time. She's wearing this hair shirt or hair cloth, and she's feeling vainglorious. That is, she's feeling really proud of herself for being so spiritual and holy. And so God punishes her again, this time with super lusty thoughts. She's having super lusty thoughts all the time. And she says in this book, it wasn't even for her husband. Like, she can't even countenance the idea of sleeping with her husband. She'd rather drink the muck from the channel. But she's having these lusty thoughts about another man. One day the man says to her, Marjorie, it's time for you to sleep with me very soon. And if you don't sleep with me now, well, it's going to happen sooner or later. And you might not have a choice about it. So Marjorie goes home and she sleeps all night. Well, she lies there all night next to her husband and she thinks about it. And she actually really does want to get it on with this guy. So she goes to him the next day and says, okay, let's do it. And he says, no way. I would rather be cut into 1,000 pieces, cut into bite-sized pieces, really, than sleep with you. And Marjorie is feeling kind of humiliated, and she figures, well, this is divine punishment for how she's feeling. Maybe she shouldn't be vainglorious anymore. But because of this tribulation that she's having, she feels like she's been forsaken by God. And she's praying and she's praying, and the Friday before Christmas, it says that Jesus speaks to her and says, hey, listen, I'm with you. I haven't left you at all. I'm going to take care of you, even though things are going to be difficult for you. You're going to be, and it says in the book, you're going to be gnawed on by the people of the world. So she's going to have a life of trials. She's just going to have to deal with it. But she should go to the local anchorite and do whatever he says. And she does this. The local anchorite says, Marjorie, you know, you're blessed by God. You should do whatever he says. You are totally holy and in the right. And Marjorie, she says, as she's going on in the book, telling the story. The story's kind of out of order, but I'm telling you kind of in the order that you find it in the book. She's having such deep conversations with Jesus here that one day she's, you know, she's praying and she's like, Jesus, what should I think about? And he sends her things to think about. Like, she thinks about the Holy Family. In this case, she's thinking about Mary and Saint Anne. When Mary is about to give birth and Marjorie is in there, she's weeping and she's thinking about this. And she's like, I will go get the swaddling clothes for baby Jesus. Like, she's very, very much into these visions and weeping all the time. She's still praying to be chaste, to be released from her marital debt to her husband. And at this time, both men and women were owed a marital debt in their marriage, which means that if either spouse wanted to have sex, the other one was supposed to have sex with them. So she's praying and praying to be chaste, to be kind of released from this part of her marriage. And Jesus is like, no problem. One day I'm going to kill your husband. It'll be fine. So this is kind of like hanging over their marriage for a while. And she tells him and he knows it, but he still, John still wants to get it on with Marjorie. And he does. One day Marjorie is praying to stop him from having sex with her. And John is not able to, and he's not able to for a while after that. And then comes the part that several medievalists I've talked to think this is their favorite part. And I think Ruth Mazo Karras is one of these people who talks about this in the podcast that we did a while ago, where Marjorie is walking. It's Friday. It's a Midsummer's Eve. She's carrying a bottle of beer. John's carrying a cake. And John says to her, Marjorie, if a man with a sword came up and threatened to cut off my head unless I slept with you, what would you do? And Marjorie's like, why are you asking? We haven't even slept together in 8 weeks. And he's kind of like, well, Marjorie, what's your answer? And she's like, I would rather he cut off your head than sleep with you again. Which is like exactly what every man wants to hear. So he says, you're not a good wife. And then they walk a little bit further and he says, okay, listen, Marjorie, I'll make you a deal. I won't sleep with you anymore if you will still sleep in the same bed with me, if you'll pay off all my debts before you go on pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and if you still eat with me on Fridays, You have to eat and drink with me on Friday nights. Now, Marjorie is fasting at this point on Fridays. She's not eating with him. So I think that, you know, if it's my opinion, and hey, it's my podcast, right? I think that John is trying to set up some pretty high expectations so that she will say, no, I can't do that. But she prays on it, and Jesus said, listen, it's fine. You can eat with him if you want. So she agrees, and from then on, she gets to live chastely, which is exactly what she wants. So Marjorie is finally allowed to be chaste in her marriage, which is something that she's wanted literally for years. And so she starts to travel around and speak to holy people and ask them questions about these visions that she's having of Jesus and of the Holy Family, and ask the holy people if what she's seeing is sent by God or sent by the devil. And basically, is she legitimately a mystic? So she goes and she speaks to lots of different people. One of the people that she stops and talks to is Julian of Norwich. And I think this is just kind of really interesting when you have moments where people who are living very different lives and they meet and kind of their paths cross, which is, I think it's really interesting because it's so rare when you have just so few documents that exist from this time period to have two people that have books that are similar and different in lots of different ways, having them actually intersect in life, I think is super interesting. So Marjorie does actually visit Julian. She stands outside of her cell and asks Julian, you know, is this real? Are the things that I'm seeing real? And the way it's written in the book, it sounds like Julian kind of gives her a ringing endorsement. But I think kind of reading it closely, it sounds like Julian's a little bit non-committal to me, which I think is fair because Marjorie is showing up and talking about herself and her visions and all her weeping and stuff. And Julian answers in a way that is very Julian if you've read her stuff. Julian is very much about God's love, and that's really what it all comes down to for her. It's very, very simple. It's all about love. So Julian says to Marjorie, you should listen to what God says to you. It's great that he's speaking to you, and you'll know that it's God that's speaking to you, or the Holy Spirit, if he's asking you to do stuff that's charitable, because the Holy Spirit is charity. So the Holy Spirit is love. And if it's directing you to do something that is against that, then you know not to listen to it. She also says, because Marjorie is telling Julian, everybody hates my weeping. They are making fun of me. They're being mean to me. And Julian says, I will pray for you that you have perseverance and that you're patient. So Julian is one of the people that Marjorie speaks to find out more about herself, whether she's legitimate, whether the things that she's hearing are true. I do make fun of Marjorie a little bit because I think, you know, it would be very difficult to live in a house or a town with her. You know, you just want to go to church every Sunday, and there's this woman who's just wailing so loudly you can't hear the priest. But I do think that Marjorie is genuine in a lot of ways, even if she does have trouble with vainglory. So Marjorie has all sorts of different stories going around talking to holy people. One of my favorites is early on, she talks to a bunch of monks in a monastery, and one monk's like, if you are true, then tell me what my sins are and if I'll be forgiven. And so Marjorie prays on this and she weeps on it, and she says to the monk, your sins are lechery and despair and doubt. And the monk says, is it lechery with single women or with wives? And Marjorie says, it's with wives. And the monk's like, okay, you got me. Am I going to be forgiven for this? And Marjorie says, of course you'll be forgiven for this. She goes to Canterbury and she weeps so long and so loudly that her husband sneaks out pretending he doesn't know her. This is not a great thing for him to do, because when she comes out, the townspeople call her a Lollard, so they call her a heretic, and they threaten her with burning. They don't actually mean it. I think this is just people getting, you know, getting their knickers in a twist outside of the church. But she's saved by being brought home by two young gentlemen who are nice and they treat her well. But things don't always go well for her. She, at one point, actually is arrested. She's minding her own business after weeping all day in the church, and she's back in the place where she's staying. She gets stopped by the mayor. The mayor comes in and takes her stuff and basically says, well, he calls her a strumpet. He calls her a false strumpet and a Lollard, so again, calling her a heretic, and he wants to send her to jail. So he gets the jailer involved, and the jailer says, well, I don't have anywhere for her to stay that's not just full of men. So the place where they'd be holding prisoners. It's full of men, and he doesn't think this is right. So instead, the jailer takes her home to his house, and he treats her very well. He locks her in a bedroom during the night, but he lets her go to church, and he feeds her well and stuff. And this is the closest that Marjorie gets to really being in trouble. The mayor of Leicester puts the two companions she has, the two pilgrims that are traveling with her, in jail with men this time. And there's such a big storm that people of the town think maybe this is a problem. So the mayor takes them out, questions them, figures they're not a threat. He takes Marjorie out and gets her questioned by some clerics in the town. And they say, you know, she seems legit, or at least we don't really want to mess with this. So the mayor finally says, what seems to be his actual problem with Marjorie, which is, why are you going about dressed like a nun? You should be home with your husband. You're setting a bad example for the wives of this town, and you're going to make all our wives follow you. So Marjorie kind of, she deals with that. She confesses to the priests and the abbot, the local abbot. She tells them she was asked to do this. She was legitimized. She was allowed to go around in white, and that's why she's wearing it. And the mayor of Leicester, who doesn't want to lose face, says, okay, fine. If you can get a letter from the bishop, I will just let this go. So she does. She gets a letter from the bishop, and she's let off. And she's all right. But that was a pretty close call for her. She was in danger, but she comes from a good family. Her dad was a high up person in Lynn. Her husband was well known in Lynn, too. So that probably had something to do with it. That, and you really don't want to mess with people who might be holy and might not. She does go on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. You'll remember that her husband wanted her to pay his debts before she went to Jerusalem. This is one of my favorite parts of the book as well, because she's going to Jerusalem. And I don't know if you've ever traveled with somebody who's annoying, but it's difficult. It's difficult. So she's traveling with these companions, a company of people. They're all going to Jerusalem, and she annoys them so much that they can't take it anymore. She's talking about God even at the dinner table, and they just can't stand it. So they threaten to leave her behind. Somebody who's nice allows her to come with them. So they kind of relent a little bit. But they threaten to make her servant abandon her as well. They're like, we'll take care of your servant. Your servant will get home fine. But we just cannot travel with you anymore. They're passive aggressive in that when they get a ship together, they don't order bedding for her. She has to fend for herself. They take her clothes. She has to dress as a fool, so she doesn't get a full length gown. She has to wear this canvas outfit that just goes below her knees, which is undignified. So it's hard for her. She has a hard time. But, I mean, you know, she's still on with the weeping all the time. She's on the road to Jerusalem, and she almost falls off her donkey when she sees it because she's crying so hard. So, you know, it's one of these moments where you really see the humanity of both sides, or at least I do. Marjorie, she's just genuinely feeling it. At the same time, you can't really blame her traveling companions for wanting to toss her overboard. Eventually, Marjorie hasn't been living with her husband for a long time. I mean, they're not living together as man and wife anyway. I guess he's kind of released her from the idea that she's supposed to sleep in the same bed with him. But one day, John falls down the stairs. And again, it kind of shows you how many small details there are in this book that are really interesting, that tell you a little bit about life in the Middle Ages. It's noteworthy that he falls down the stairs barefoot and bare-legged. So I don't really know if this is because, you know, he should have been wearing shoes, so maybe he'd have more grip on the stairs, or maybe his fall is just that much more undignified, because when John falls down the stairs, he hits his head. It's a really bad injury. And the neighbors think if Marjorie had been there, maybe this wouldn't have happened. Another note that I think is interesting is the neighbors know that he's fallen down the stairs because they hear it, which kind of gives you an idea of a small thing, like how close together the houses were in Lynn at the time. So Marjorie moves in to take care of him. She moves in and lives with him as a good wife, although they are living chastely. And in the last couple of years of his life, it's not clear whether it's because of this head injury or not, but John deteriorates physically. He becomes incontinent, so she's cleaning him up. And it says that she would have resented him, except for she remembers how much she loved his body, how much she lusted after his body, how much she just loved him. And I remember like reading this and thinking, wow, that's really sweet. That's a really sweet sentiment. You know, you're cleaning up someone. You could be resentful, but how much did you love them over your life together? And then she says, so it was great that she's punished with the same body because that's appropriate, which is just such a Marjorie Kemp thing. You know, it was like, you had to ruin it, Marjorie. It was a nice sentimental moment. Yeah, so she lives with John. She takes care of him until the end of his life. We don't know how Marjorie's story ends. She has a lot of kids. She has 14 kids. I mean, no wonder she wanted to live chastely after that. She has 14 kids. She has interactions with her son, which you find out a bit later. But we don't know what happened to Marjorie in the end. So she kind of disappears. And because she's writing this before the end of her life, you don't get that kind of closure that you do at the end of most saints' lives, which are told posthumously. This one, she's got commissioned during her lifetime. So we don't get to find out what that major sin was that she was confessing all the time, and we don't get to find out what happens to her in the end. But that said, it is still a really super interesting story. You get all these fine details, like people's grumbling, or, you know, going down the stairs barefoot being a problem. The fact that Marjorie is walking with her husband on a Friday, Midsummer Night's Eve, and she's got beer and he's got cake. Like, these are wonderful little details that give you insight, or at least just a window onto the Middle Ages in the 15th century. It's also a really good book because you can see how much agency Marjorie has. So she's a wife. She's a middle-class wife. Her father, as I've said, has been fairly important in the town. But she's able to start brewing as a business, and she says she does it for pride. So she doesn't necessarily need it for money or necessarily for the house. So she's doing this for extra money, which is not necessary. She also has her second business. So she has a lot of agency in her life as a businesswoman, which is really, really interesting, I think. She also has a lot of agency in that she travels a lot, and she doesn't travel alone. She always travels with a servant or companions or people who believe in her and her visions. So she travels with people, but she travels a lot, almost constantly, it seems, which is probably a relief to the congregation in Lynn, right? It's really interesting too that she has the agency to ask for audiences with all these holy people. So she speaks to the Archbishop of Canterbury. She ends up speaking to abbots all over the place. She speaks to a papal legate. She spends a lot of time in Venice. She goes to Jerusalem and speaks to holy people there. She gets to speak to Julian, who I don't think would turn her away. But again, all of these people, she has the agency. She has the guts to go and actually speak to them. And she has the guts to have people write her story for her. So she's doing it because God has instructed her to have her story written down. But at the same time, this is kind of unprecedented to have your own sort of saint's life written down. And it does feel like a pitch for sainthood. And I'm not the first person to think this either. There's some things in here about miracles. One time, again, another interesting thing that happens to her, a piece of the church ceiling falls down and hits her in the back and hits her in the head, and she's fine, which is miraculous. So miracles and also the tribulations that she has, they all seem to suggest that she's kind of angling for sainthood here. So the guts to actually hire people to write her story and kind of make this kind of pitch for being a holy woman or a mystic, I think is kind of incredible in itself. And she is writing it, she is having this written in her lifetime. So you can kind of see her hand in the background. People would be reading back to her what they've written. She would be the person who would be correcting it or making sure that certain things were included and certain things weren't included. So as an editor as well, this is really interesting as a book. I can't help but think that she would really love social media if she was living today. She would be going around with people, friends, having them take pictures of her, you know, with the Pope or something. Hashtag blessed. She's a real operator. And I think this is, it's really interesting. Again, so having read this, at the same time or shortly before or after I read Julian of Norwich's book, you can see different ways in which people experienced their religious devotion at the time. So you have somebody like Julian who has very, very private devotion. She is an anchorite. She's enclosed. So she's really kind of experiencing her visions of Jesus, which are very tactile as well, in a very private way. And then you have Marjorie, whose experience of devotion is very, very public. She is always out there talking to people about herself. She's always out there weeping in the middle of the church. It's almost performative, her devotion. And it's very, very different how they're experiencing it. But at the same time, there are similarities in that they are both having visions of Jesus as a man, his life, his mother's life, what these are like as human experiences. And that's really interesting. And that's something that you do see in the early 15th century, this phenomenon called affective piety, where especially women are really concentrating on the humanity of Jesus. So, you know, maybe I haven't done Marjorie justice. Maybe I've made fun of her a little bit too much. Fair enough. I tend to do that. But the Book of Marjorie Kemp is really a worthwhile read. It's not all that difficult. It is in Middle English, but it's not all that difficult. It's probably on par with Chaucer, I would say. You can read it in the Teams edition, which is edited by Lynn Staley, and you can find that online if you like. But it's really worth reading in terms of finding out more about a woman's life in general, about her agency, about devotion at this time, and about how you might be experiencing your faith at that time, even if it's not kind of as over the top as Marjorie's. So next time you hear people making fun of Marjorie Kemp or thinking about Marjorie Kemp or enjoying Marjorie Kemp, now you'll know who we're talking about. She is definitely a unique personality and definitely worth reading more about. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey, so the big news this week kind of involves one of your recent guests.
Ooh, Matt Chapman. That's right.
Yeah, he apparently was like a lone archaeologist at this Tudor era house in England. And he was like exploring and trying to find stuff, and he went under the floorboards. And he found all this stuff dating back from the 15th century all the way to the 20th century. Just been hidden there for centuries. No one's, you know, even bothered to look at it. And he's kind of found it. That's really kind of a nice little treasure trove of archaeology. So we have that news about that on the site. And we also have your piece on how to make a king fall in love.
Yeah, that one's really bizarre.
I think it's really useful. So I think everyone should, you know, want to read that one because that's some powerful magic there. So
yeah, if you ever find yourself in a time machine, pack all of this stuff because you might need it.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of which, I've got a gazelle's brain and I wanted to know if you wanted the other half.
You just have it just lying around. Did you order from Amazon or something?
I went to the zoo.
Wow, Peter. Wow, that's dark. All right. So we've got Matt Champion, his amazing discovery on the website. He was telling us a little bit about that when he was on the podcast, I think. And we've got Gazelle Brains and How Else to Make a King Fall in Love with You. Anything else I'm missing?
Oh, we've got some bits of on the Hundred Years' War from our columnists coming up. We'll have more about for our series on medieval Scandinavia and just kind of like other kind of posts. Our writers, I'm going to be coming through in the next couple of days, so with a bunch of stuff. So very happy on that.
Awesome. It's always great to talk to you, Peter. See you later.
Thanks.
There's actually more exciting news for all you fans of medieval podcasts, as medievalist.net is now your go-to site for not one, but three historical podcasts. As of now, clicking on the podcast link at medievalist.net will bring you to episodes of The Medieval Podcast with yours truly, Byzantium and Friends with Anthony Caldelis, who I spoke to on this podcast not that long ago, and The Scottish Chronicast with Kate Buchanan. It's your one-stop shop for all sorts of podcast goodness, and I couldn't be happier to be sharing a link with these two. You can find all three podcasts at medievalist.net/category/podcast. Thank you, as always, to all of our patrons on patreon.com for keeping this podcast going. Whether you're a patron for the sweet deals on Medieval Warfare Magazine, the Medieval Magazine, our book club, or just because you love the podcast, you have my eternal gratitude. And it's official. As of this week, patrons who sign up to support us at the map levels for the month of August will be getting a map of Africa in the 14th century. Super cool. Illustrated by Tina Ross. Our maps are made exclusively for our patrons as an extra special thank you from us to you. Find out more about our maps and all our rewards at patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from Marjorie Kemp to up-to-the-minute archaeology, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can follow me, Danielle Cebulski, on social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist. And you can find all my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an amazing day.